My name is David Seidenberg, and I have a number of affiliations, but my main thing as a public face right now seems to be my website, which is neochassid.org. And in terms of my work, I focus on ecology, and I have a doctorate in ecology and Kabbalah. So when I think of human rights, I'm thinking about how it sits and situates in the context of the question of the rights, the well-beings, justice for all beings and not just for people. That means resisting some assumptions we make about human rights. And what I want to present to you, I think, just scratches the surface of that question, and I'm not sure whether I'm scratching the right surface or not, even, you know. But I'm hoping that between us we will get some critical thinking going here. Now, on a personal level, for me, Judaism was always about connection to the earth through the rituals, the cycle of the calendar and Shabbat. And that's what brought me into it. So the strong sort of interhuman ethical dimension, which is often the most compelling force for people, was not the one for me, even though those things are obviously extremely important to me as well. But that wasn't the thing that compelled me to think Judaism has answers that I can't get elsewhere, which led me to a certain picture of the tradition, which some of you may share. And I guess that's sort of the starting point of this discussion for me. Because, of course, Shabbat has a human rights dimension, what could call it, in terms of rest and the right of people to not be enslaved. And, of course, it has the sense of resting the earth. On that level, it really seems to unite the question of, let's leave aside the question of rights for the moment, right relationship between human beings and right relationship with the earth or with the land. And, of course, Shabbat is only practice for the big Shabbat of Shemitah and the even bigger Shabbat of Yovel. And these mitzvot are very clearly about the land, and they're also equally clearly about justice for humans. So we'll get into some of the pratim, and we'll read a little text on this.
That's a radical statement you just made, I think. If I heard you right, Shabbat is only practice for the bigger Shabbat of Shemitah and the really big Shabbat of Yovel?
Right. That is what I said. Right. Well, just is not a small word.
An end in itself or a...
Is just... It's both just practice, and it is the most just practice that one could do in order to learn it. So it is both on those levels. Yes. And my own reading of the Torah is that those mitzvot are, in fact, the whole point of the covenant. And I could do a study session with you just on that, tracing how, just on the level of Leitvot, and how the laws of Shemitah and Yovel appear to call on themes from Genesis and from all the falls that happen in the human relationship with God and with the earth, which always fall in parallel, never not in parallel, and show how those mitzvot specifically are echoing and fixing those falls, those shviras. And, of course, the parsha in which these things appear is Bahar Sinai. These are the mitzvot of Sinai. Rashi and the commentaries ask, what does Shemitah and Yovel have to do with Sinai? Mashemitah etzel Sinai. But the obvious answer is because that's the whole point of Sinai, even though that's not the answer given by the commentaries.
Can you go over that again?
Yeah.
The Sinai is...
The question is, why does the Parsha begin? These are, because they got a lot of laws at Sinai already. Why do they have to say that there? Because this is the point, one could say.
Do you want to be interrupted or not?
I do want to be interrupted, as long as we keep focus.
By talking about it theoretically, it's okay. I mean, I live in Israel, and I choose, you know, not to observe Shemitah. And because I'm actively choosing not to observe Shemitah, by what you're saying, you know, I have a little disconnect. Yet I'm against it for me. You know, other people fine. But
I don't know what it means to be against it, because they don't observe Shemitah in Israel. What Shemitah is in the Torah, I know people throw food in the ocean and things like that, and they sell the land.
Shemitah that you don't buy. Or yourself.
I know, but I'm talking about the laws in the Torah, as opposed to the laws that they observe in the breach. Shemitah and Yovel require a radical reformulation of the economic basis of society. They require each family to have their own land, and in essence, each person has a right to land. Without that, there's no Shemitah and no Yovel, because the whole point is that each person has a permanent connection to a piece of land, which never goes away no matter what happens economically. and that they revisit that connection at least once every 50 years. And it works on so many levels. But one level which is actually less obvious, which I want to mention here, is that we worry about population growth on the one hand, and on the other hand, I'm ignoring the Jewish dimension of the issue for the moment. And on the other hand, we worry about how you would deal with population growth in a way that would not be fascistic. But Shemitah and Yovel do that, because if you have to face the fact that this land supports your family, then you have to make realistic decisions about how big you want your family to be that have nothing to do with any imposition from any authority or outside social force, and therefore can be made in complete freedom and still be made appropriately, which we can't do in a society where our relationship to the earth is completely separated by so many levels, so that I can't understand the impact of my family and the number of people in any rational way. But that doesn't have to do with human rights, except in a roundabout way, because countries that worry about population growth in a more authoritarian way often violate human rights, such as China. So now I want to go to the question of what is rights and what that means. I'm sure it's on everyone's minds, and I know that Moshe Halbertal spoke last night about holiness as a connection to rights. I don't want to use that framework today, although you might want to bring it back in. But I want to talk about rights as a kind of specific class of obligation for the moment. And first of all, in Western society, rights doesn't translate into anything except intrinsic to the subject. But practically, it means if you have a right, I and society and all levels of society have an obligation to protect that right. So practically, it's an obligation. And it's an obligation on everyone towards the subject, rather than an intrinsic just desert of the subject. It's a claim on other people and on greater structure society. And also specifically, it implies that no matter how much power or force I or a community or society have, we don't have the right to use that force in violation of that right of that person. So it's about power balance as well. So I think in terms of obligations, there's lots of obligations that we have that are mutual, where we have equal power, and in that equal power, we have obligations to each other that stand in parity. And I don't want to call those rights for the moment. What I want to look at as a right is the case where there is overwhelming power on one side and defined right on the other side that balances that potentially overwhelming power or unchecked power, let's put it that way. That's one side of it. And the other side of it is when you have a right, it doesn't matter whether you respect my rights, you still have that right. And so it also is unbalanced in the other direction, so that you may have no obligation to me and yet I still have that obligation to you. So from that perspective, it's very hard to find things that can be called rights between Jewish people in the Torah. From both those angles, I'll explain what I mean by giving the counterexamples. Gerim have lots of rights in the Torah because they don't have those obligations, nor do they have that power. And therefore, society has these obligations to the Gerim. I'm not talking about Ger Tzedek versus Ger Toshav, ignoring the halachic ramifications for the moment, but just looking at the Torah. So we have an obligation to love the stranger, but the Torah doesn't tell the stranger that the stranger has an obligation to love us because the Torah isn't directed at the stranger. Kegerka Ezrach assumes that the Ezrach, which is a class of mutually responsible people, has the requirement to extend those mutualities to those who do not share them, the Ger. In that sense, the other classes of rights that might exist are the obligations we have to animals, because they have no obligations back to us, such as respecting the Dam, which is the Nefesh, or not muzzling an ox when it's threshing corn. So the ox, in a sense, has a right not to be muzzled. But there's one more layer, which is that a right implies the possibility of enjoying the right or expressing it. And so it's not just that the ox can't be muzzled, but the ox in that sense must actually have the opportunity to eat the corn or the grain if it wants to. In that sense, the only place where a right is clearly articulated is the land and not with any other subject. Because the land has the right to a Shabbat of the Shemitah year. It has no obligation in return back to us. If we don't fulfill that right, we lose our rights, which are actually not rights, to live on the land. There's no right to the land. Promised land doesn't mean right to the land. It means the opposite. It means God makes a promise that God will kick you out if you don't do the right thing. And so it's actually much more complicated. Obviously, that has ramifications for how we deal with Israel and all kinds of things, which are not relevant to our topic right now. So, v'tirtza ha'aretz et shabtoteha. The land will enjoy her Shabbats, that she will desire, she will will them to come into being. If you support that, if you respond to that as a right, then you will live. And if not, God will respond to it as a right and make sure it gets fulfilled regardless of what you do. That is much more the definition of right than anything else. So it seems to me that there are two grounds from which to build a notion. There are maybe many more, but there are two obvious grounds. The one that's obvious to everyone and the one that's obvious to me that I'm talking to you about right now. The one that's obvious to everyone is B'Tselem Elohim, that humans have a unique status. This status implies some kind of intrinsic value or infinite value or soul. It could be based on any number of things, and throughout Jewish history it's been given many, many interpretations, and that's what I wrote my dissertation about, actually. You know, so it could have to do with intellect, it could have to do with richness of experience, capacity to receive and understand pain, capacity to know the future, intentionality. It can have any number of things that are embedded in that question of intrinsic value. But however you construct it, if you start from Tzelem Elohim, there's no basis on which to talk about the rights of anything but human beings. At least no obvious way. Towards the end, I'll get to something else that actually combines the two. Now, that's not a problem if we're only looking at human rights. But it is a problem if we're looking at the whole moral sphere and the degree to which rights or something similar enough to rights accrue to beings other than human beings. So do species have a right to not be forced into extinction? Does the land have a right not to be forced into empty desolation by human beings? Is that a right? If we just stick with philosophical rights languages, it's hard to simply stretch it. But if we talk about things like just desserts, as Len Goodman does, you may or may not know his work, but he's someone worth reading, Len Goodman, or subjecthood and degrees of subjecthood, so that we're not talking about something that either is or is not, but something that is or is more, and then we can get a sense of graduated rights, so to speak. But interestingly, even that is not as strong as the Torah, because, as I said before, the strongest right is not for human beings, it's for the land itself. So if we start from the only place where right is articulated, because there's nothing about right that's articulated in Tzelem Elohim, it's simply a natural interpretation that we make. It hasn't always been made even that way. Mm-hmm. It's relatively modern to extend it in that particular direction, even though I think it's a great interpretation and a good drush. If we start from the only place where there is actual rights, then we start from the land as ultimate subject, and that God's covenantal partner is first and foremost the land, and then humans to the extent that they align with that covenant. Now again, we could go through a whole study of Genesis and all the stages of the human relationship with the earth, how it parallels the relationship with God, and show how that is sort of fixed in Shemitah and how that relates to what I'm saying. And if you want to ask more questions and debate on that, we can certainly do that. But I want to go a little bit in some other directions. So most of what I said is after the quotes on this page I gave you in a few shorter sentences. So you can look at that. I want to look at the quotes at the top for the moment, but feel free to let your eyes wander. So the first quote I think is very, very helpful to us, from Tom Sperry. The world is a community of subjects, not a collection of objects. So normally, in ethical theory, we talk about humans as the only ones that are actually subjects. And that has a long tradition. It's most strongly expressed in Kant. The only beings that can be considered subjects and ends in themselves are rational beings, which for Kant could include Martians or any other, I mean, it didn't have to be humans, but they have to be rational beings. And that's what you get, the categorical imperative, which only applies to those rational beings. So only rational beings have the right to be treated as ends. But of course, we want to say that everything is most justly treated as an end to the extent that it's possible to do so, and not just rational beings. And that means everything is a subject. But the word communion is perhaps more important than the word subject in Thomas Berry's statement, because when we think of a communion, we must think of our mutuality with all things. To use the Native American phrase, all my relations, and not just my human relations. And it also implies a kind of sacrality to that relationship that I think actually does go back to what Moshe Halbertal was speaking about in important ways. So the second quote comes from Aldo Leopold, and a lot of the thinking that I'm bringing to you here is expressed sort of most clearly and firstly in this essay that Aldo Leopold wrote called Land Ethic, which makes numerous mistakes about the Bible. It's not a good reading of Tanakh, but that's not the point. It's a good reading of a problem that we face. So this is sort of the sentence from Leopold that everyone quotes. To the right on here, you have a number of paragraphs excerpted from this essay, which is relatively short, like 8 pages. Well, we'll just start with this quote. A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. A very kind of clear and beautiful idea. Doesn't have to do with rights, though. It has to do with ethics. means the community of living things that are in relationship to each other. But not just that, it means all the material sustenance and energy that supports that community of beings. And so it starts with the land, as well as the sun and the water that come into the land, and then all the beings that come out of that.
What this puts me in mind of is Psalm 104, which describes an interdependent ecosystem created by how the different animals are and what they feed upon.
Come over here. And then ask your question, and then you can go back.
Okay. So the question really is, not just what does Torah have to say in terms of imbuing the land with rights, but also what does Torah have to say about this biotic community? And it seems to me that Psalm 104 actually lifts up a description that we're supposed to attend to. We're supposed to understand that it means that we have an obligation to be in right relationship with the whole.
What you're saying is so powerful that wherever you stand in the room, it creates this amazing effect.
Not only that, in Psalm 104, but I mean, there's this ancient text, Perek Shirah, which lists praise that each part of creation really offers. Each part of the biotic community has its own relationship with God.
We're talking about Perek Shirah in Psalm 104, which I'm repeating in case the tape totally obliterated what you said, and apologize to anyone listening to this because of the feedback, because of my sore throat. So those elements are important. I never use them in my work because I think poetry, you can't fully justify theology on poetry in the face of people who disagree with you. If they agree with you, poetry works fine, but otherwise it doesn't. And so that's why I don't use those texts. But once we agree, those texts become wonderful sort of fabric for strengthening, deepening the things we're talking about. Absolutely. So where were we? Ethics, going from ethics to rights. Again, so that's actually a lot of what the question is. How do you move from an ethical sense about the whole world and the earth and the species to a sense of rights in the whole world and the species? Or do we want to reserve rights just for human beings? It's not obvious that one has to go one way or the other, but I know my feeling is towards the first. That is, when I look at the earth, I think of it as having rights, that is, obligations that are of such high value upon me that I must subsume any of my desires to those senses of obligation, just as I would towards another person. That, by the way, gets to something else that Moshe Halbertal was speaking about, which is Levinas and the idea of the infinite face of the other. And do we count the earth as another? Are humans the only ones with a face? It's something that Levinas actually does not deal with directly very much in his work, although he hints in a few places. There's an essay about a dog, which one could read into if one wishes, for example. Let's just read the Shemitah, a little bit of the Shemitah text, just so we have a common resonance of what we're talking about. I think because of the feedback, I should do all the reading. And you, of course, will be able to understand what I'm saying because you can look at it. In the seventh year of Shabbat, Shabbaton, it will be for the land, a Shabbat for Adonai. And the Shabbat of the land will be for you all for eating, for you and for your servant and your hired worker and your settler who is alien among you, and for your animal, and for the wild animal which is in your land. And you will make holy the 50th year and call out to roar in the land to all those living in her. It will be a jubilee for you. You will return each man to his tribe, possession, and to his family. And the land will give her fruit, and you will eat and be satisfied, and you will settle securely on her. In the land you may not sell, latzmitut, permanently, for the land is mine, for aliens and settlers you are by me. In all the land of your tribe possessions you will give geula, redemption, to the land. I haven't put in here the Leviticus 26, which says what happens if you don't do this, and you know how long those curses go on for, and how clear it is that the land's needs are going to come before your needs when they stand in conflict. But I do want to underline a few little elements here for the moment. First, the line about who gets to eat what underlines very much that there's a fusion of ethics between communal peers, all people, whether they have power or not, and all animals. In fact, one of the clues that this text really is a return to some kind of status of Gan Eden is this emphasis that the Chaya is going to eat anything along with you. Because the state of Gan Eden is that everyone has sort of equal eating rights. And that's one of the main things that changes at each stage of dissension, ultimately in the eating of animals by humans. So this is a return to this place of equality between all animals. That's one thing. As well as the strong emphasis on interhuman relationships.
Yeah. We should be vegetarian in the Shemitah year?
No, I don't think that it means that. Although, I don't want to say on that point. The other thing is that liberty, or Torah, which we certainly think of as freedom in the right sense, in the Liberty Bell sense, to all the inhabitants, kol yosheveha. Now, does that mean just human beings? what does Kol Yisrael mean, all beings? And it's not obvious that a text needs to be interpreted one way or the other, but it certainly can be interpreted in both directions. The third point, on the overt level, you must give up your needs in order to fulfill the needs of the land. But the promise of covenant, which is one of the ways in which it's different than rights language, is that when you do this, actually it's not different than how we think about rights. When you do this, give up your needs, you actually will get your needs fulfilled. And if you try to get your needs at the expense, you will actually not get your needs. But that is actually how we think about, like, freedom of speech. I'm going to give you freedom of speech, and I'm going to get it too, and it's going to work that way. So that fits the idea of redemption, ge'ulah. And one thing about human rights, it seems to me, is that we don't often talk about it in terms of how it relates to Mashiach Tzeitz, in the sense of an ultimate transformation. Yes, obviously, in a just society, no human rights would ever be violated. Would the cessation of violating human rights mean Mashiach Tzeitz? Or could that happen in an averagely bad society anyway, which just isn't that bad? You know, the question, is this work on human rights pointing to a redemptive idea or not?